You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello, Heat Nation. I'm David Ramil, the host of Locked On Heat, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Please make sure to follow the show if you haven't already, wherever you listen to podcasts, to get the latest episodes. Today's episode is brought to you by RockAuto.com. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car will ever need. Make sure you visit RockAuto.com and tell them Locked On sent you. Even as the Miami Heat are limping their way to the end of the 2021 season, it might be time to remember that this team had a magical run in last year's playoffs, and there's no one better to help relive some of those incredible memories than the host of the Open Floor podcast, a writer with the Washington Post, but most importantly, the author of Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. It's Ben Golliver. How are you doing, Ben?
I'm doing very well, and I remember fondly our chats when I was living in the bubble for 93 days. I know we talked Heat at least a couple times when I was down there. It was always good to have sort of like outside the Disney World perspective, because it was a very strange time in my life. You know, felt very cut off and isolated from the outside world. So it was good to know that the rest of the earth was still turning as we were down there kind of following the Heat and their ride to the NBA Finals.
Yeah, I mean, those conversations, if talking to new listeners here and you haven't had a chance to listen to those, I think we actually connected on three separate occasions, even before the actual seeding games began, those eight seeding games. I think we talked about the actual just the process, you know, something that as you know, you detail in the book, of course, but you also talk about, you know, how difficult it was to go through testing, the regular testing, the fact that you had been quarantined for a certain amount of time. And so we were able to talk about those details during our earliest podcast. And then once the playoffs actually talked, I think we talked during the Eastern Conference Finals, and then we talked after the season as well. So a good, you know, kind of breaking points there for you know, catching up on the Heat, especially with your insider's perspective. So we'll be talking about the bubble, of course, but we'll also be looking at the current Miami season. But before getting into all that, just want to let everybody know the book is available for pre-order right now in hardcover on Amazon.com or other bookshops as well, and will be available as of May 4th. So absolutely get yourself a copy. I think I knew the outcome, of course, and I can honestly say that I was still riveted, like reading parts of the book, especially about the finals and the way you describe Jimmy Butler, the flow of everything. I mean, I like to think I'm a pretty okay writer myself, but I found myself just captivated by the way you were detailing everything and describing it. Even though you follow like a normal sequential timeline there, you still kind of created this energy to the whole thing. And I was so excited to read what would happen next, even though I already knew the outcome. So I can't think of a higher compliment than that one, because you really just put all your readers in the moment there. At least that's what I got out of it.
Well, I really appreciate that. I mean, I had a really good time covering the games down in the bubble. Look, the bubble was hard. You know, I put on weight when I was down there. I wasn't sleeping well. Like I said, I had the isolation sensation from my families and from everybody else who wasn't down in Disney World. You know, we couldn't drive cars. We couldn't really do anything except for, you know, kind of eat by ourselves and, you know, walk around this oval track day after day after day, which I kind of kept passing Eric Spoelstra almost every single day in September as he's going to getting closer and closer to the NBA Finals and making sure that he has his own outlet for the stress and pressure that kind of goes with those stakes, right? You know, the games themselves were incredibly entertaining. I went to every single playoff game from the second round on in all the series. And it's the kind of thing for a basketball junkie like myself. I'm a summer league guy. You know, I'm listening to all sorts of podcasts about basketball every single day, you know, like I'm sure a lot of your readers do and listeners. And for me, it was like basketball heaven from that standpoint. And so I wanted to be the person to kind of document all those layers. And for me, the Jimmy Butler angle was especially interesting because I had written my first cover story for Sports Illustrated and the first cover story of his career on a national magazine back in 2015 when he was a member of the Bulls. So it really felt like a full circle moment kind of for both of us in tandem in a way, and to see him like, you know, fully at the peak of his powers, trying desperately to get revenge against LeBron for some of those earlier career losses in head-to-head in playoff situations, and just coming up just short, you know, with all these challenging circumstances with the injuries around him. I thought it was just a really poignant push for Jimmy in particular and for the Heat in general. And so I wanted to kind of capture, you know, their despair at the end, as well as, of course, the Lakers' excitement at winning the title and all the accomplishments they had along the way. Look, I mean, I misread the Heat. They upset the Milwaukee Bucks. I really didn't see that coming. when, you know, push came to shove, I favored the Celtics slightly in the Eastern Conference Finals. They proved me wrong there as well. Mm-hmm. I did never see Bam breaking through as like a lead game defining presence in a high level playoff games this early in his career, not by a long shot. And I don't think that many people expected it when he's kind of turning the Eastern Conference Finals with that incredible block against Jason Tatum early on. And then the incredible fourth quarter takeover, you know, to seal off that series. I mean, it was phenomenal basketball and really fun to watch. And so I tried to get behind the main characters and including Spoelstra and of course the Heat stars too.
Yeah, you touch on a lot of the great Heat-related points that you include. You were kind enough to send me a proof of the book and mention to me which particular chapters were most Heat-centric, but you did touch on a lot of those things too. So I'll start off with your last statement there about Eric Spoelstra. I found it so interesting how you kept running into him and you described his whole approach to the game and also how much like Brad Stevens he was, in your opinion, that they both worked their way up the ranks. They were both fairly young, relatively, and that they were so, you know, dedicated to the game and everything else. And to touch on what you had mentioned as far as, you know, a great, great story from you about, you know, going around and doing your daily laps and dealing with the incredible Florida humidity. And there's Spo just trudging along like he's not even fazed by the whole thing and wearing, of course, a T-shirt that reads only two words, Heat culture. That is so perfectly Spoelstra, who I think actually lost weight. I think, and seeing him regularly during Zoom calls, even before they left for the bubble, just I could tell that he actually lost weight. Whereas you gained weight, and I mean, just within that kind of environment, you could see the monotony of it all. You just would sit around eating and just, you know, lazing about. Spoelstra took the opportunity to get into better shape. He went in there with the thought process of trying to work harder and outwork everybody else, and he succeeded. It's phenomenal.
No, for sure. Look, I was trying to do the same thing too. I was out there walking, you know, I think I tried to average, you know, over the last year, especially during the quarantine, I've been trying to average like 8 miles a day walking, which sounds like an insane number. But for me, like it helps with my writing process. It helps with my mental health. And so I've really been pretty devoted to it. But just the stress and like the late nights and those, you know, veggie burgers at 1 a.m. when you're trying to file your story and all that, that just catches up to you. Yeah. And with Spoelstra, I mean, it was like a self-parody. You know, I mean, we're out there. And again, the bubble started off pretty busy because you had 22 teams,
right?
You know, like 350, 400 players, a lot of people down there, but it slowly started to winnow down. So by the time you got to the conference finals, you only have four teams left. It's not a very big bubble. It's all a contained environment. So you run into the same people over and over again. And I think a lot of the people who were down there with exercise routines, there was a gym indoors. I didn't feel comfortable from a health and safety standpoint. You know, working out in that gym. So that's why I was, you know, sticking to my outdoor walking routine. But most people were smart enough to do their exercise before noon or after dark, right? Because the temperature is much better in August and September in Orlando, and there's not as much humidity if you can avoid those early afternoon hours. But for whatever reason, I didn't have a choice. And so I'd be walking, you know, for a mile, mile and a half and not see anybody else, but almost guaranteed every single day, Eric Spoelstra would be out there, like you said, that Heat culture T-shirt. I mean, looking like he's just typecast from a movie and just, you know, walking so purposefully, clearly, like you're saying, you know, probably weighing strategic decisions in that night's lineup, you know, combinations that might work or when he's going to spring his zone defense on the opposition, all of it. And for me, it was fascinating because I remember covering the Heatles. Those were some of my first finals that I covered. And I remember seeing Spoelstra in those press conferences really not seem particularly comfortable. And it was, I think part of it, it was just the secrecy element. If he didn't want to give anything away and he didn't really enjoy the back and forth repartee with reporters, you know, he's not one of these Doc Rivers jovial guys.
No.
He just wanted to get in and get out. And in my mind at that point, I thought, huh, is this just his youth, right? Or his inexperience where he's being thrust into the situation where he's got to coach LeBron and everybody expects a title. So therefore he's almost overcompensating in a way and, you know, trying to, you know, come off like a little bit hard to the media and, you know, almost like, you know, trying to come up more experienced and kind of tougher minded than maybe he actually is. But I think that I just misread it earlier in his career. I think that's just exactly who he's been from the start. He's obviously worked on it and evolved and settled into his own skin in a different way. And we actually saw some really vulnerable moments from Spoelstra to the media when he was talking about Tyler Hero, when he opened up after the end of the finals as well. And, you know, it was just absolutely crestfallen at the loss. And so to me, to see his evolution as a coach and his public presentation was very cool to see up close. And, you know, he's from Portland. He went to the University of Portland. I'm from the Portland area. And so he's been kind of on my radar for a long time. His dad was an executive with the Blazers. So to kind of get that sneak peek at him in particular. I think he's a really, really important NBA figure who doesn't get it talked about enough nationally. And when I look forward to potential like next coaches of Team USA, I really hope Eric Spoelstra's in the mix, because it's the work ethic, it's the discipline, it's the schemes, the in-game coaching, it's the personality management to be able to take role players, get the most out of them, but also connect with superstar level players. That's everything you want from a national team coach. And I kind of hope that, you know, that might be in his future one day.
Wow. I honestly can tell you, I have never even considered it, just because.
See,
yeah, no,
he's underrated, David, even by you.
Look, I still think he's one of the top coaches, but I just never see him being that taking that step in his evolution as a coach, a Team USA guy. But you're absolutely right. Like, I mean, we've seen it. I've seen it. I know that for a fact. Like the way he interacts with players. I mean, just from Dwayne Wade, or you know, help mentoring him earlier in his career, and then taking on the Heatles and that challenges that came with those 4 years. And then of course the job he's done over the last seven seasons now. I mean, unbelievable the kind of work he's done. But yeah, absolutely. Team USA, let's start making the push now. If we're making a push for Jimmy as MVP or Bam Adebayo as Defensive Player of the Year, why not Eric Spoelstra for Team USA? I like that evolution for him. I think it's a great way. It's a great recruiting tool. Personally, I don't know that Spo actually would want to do it, other than I guess there's probably a part of him where he feels honored to, one, be nominated, and secondly, he would want the challenge, the opportunity to kind of coach Buddy. But unless Bam's on the team, I couldn't see him wanting to actually undertake that challenge. So that's something
that's the good part. When you're the coach, you get to pick the team. So, you know, you're bringing Bam with you. It's a package deal, all right?
No Mason Plumlee this time around, I guess. We'll take Bam to buy it.
100%. That decision's going the other way if he's the coach.
So it was, I'm glad he brought up those vulnerable moments from Spoelstra, because aside from the perfunctory wave, as you're seeing him around the track, you don't really get a chance to talk to him all that much, but you do get to see that it was a very powerful moment, I think, because I don't think I've ever seen Spoelstra that emotional ever. Like, obviously he's not, you know, required to show that kind of level of emotionality, but even as a human being, you figure there'll be some occasional moments of vulnerability, of actual real human emotion. But aside from talking about Dwayne and Dwayne's last season and everything like that, you rarely see those kinds of things from Spo. But it was harsh for me to go back there and remember that, because the bubble was such an incredible immersive emotional experience for Spo, for the Heat. And for him to just lay it all on the line like that and then have nothing left, where he was just, he couldn't contain himself. It was like the cracks in the facade were just there exposed for everybody to see. So it was hell of a moment, and you did a great job.
They left it all on the court. I mean, that's the same thing with Jimmy doubled over on the baseline, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where he's just exhausted and absolutely gassed in the NBA Finals. They left it all out on the court, and that's what's such a tribute to that group. And why I think Spoelstra remembers is always going to remember it fondly and talk about the bond within that locker room, because they gave it every single thing that they had, and they can walk away with pride and, you know, of course, bitterness at the loss. But certainly I don't think there was anything else that they could have possibly done. You know, when I'm thinking back on that, you know, final game of the bubble, I've covered every NBA final since 2011.
Yeah.
That was the most memorable championship celebration or kind of championship aftermath of any that I've covered. And there's been some really good ones. I mean, obviously 2016 with the Cavaliers and just everybody in shock at the 3-1 comeback. You know, the Heat, you had an incredible, you know, game seven after the great game six overtime to seal up that title in 2013. There's been some other ones as well. But what stuck out about 2020 in the bubble, it was a combination of the New Year's Eve party that always kind of comes when you win the championship, where you're spraying the champagne and you're excited. But it's also the college graduation, the idea of like, this is an end of a chapter. We're probably never going to come back to it. All the memories are flooding back, good and bad, and you're never going to be the same kind of afterwards, right? And like, even I've talked to some people who are in the bubble, and it's almost kind of like they talk about themselves as like bubble alumni, you know, and it's the same kind of thing. And so for the players, it was doubly emotional, especially for the Lakers. Obviously, they're winning, but for the Heat as well, because they're celebrating not only the victory, but also the fact that they get to go home. For the Heat, it's not only did we lose, but we're not going to get another shot at this experience. It's done. It's over. It's been taken away from us, right? And I think when you throw on top all of the social justice activism that we saw from both teams, including Spoelstra, who was pretty vocal on that as well, but
absolutely,
also Jimmy Butler, Bam, and many of the Lakers people, I think that added another element of the emotion too. It's not just that you're stuck at Disney World, away from your fancy houses, away from your fancy cars, away from your kids. It's not only that, it's also, this was a very heavy time in American history with that election coming up just only a few weeks after those finals. These guys have been weighing things like Breonna Taylor verdict, the Jacob Blake police shooting and everything else. And while they're having to play, you know, at the absolute peak level of performance in the NBA finals, just so many layers to it. And I think that all those things kind of came together in those emotional outpourings that you're describing.
Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit more with Ben Golliver, the author of Bubble Ball, in the next segment, and then we'll get into his thoughts on the current Miami Heat team. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Sometimes it might be better to be in a bubble, but not when you're the hiring expert for your company. And what you really need is help to make a short list of quality candidates. You need a hiring partner that helps you make your life easier. You need Indeed. Indeed is the job site to make hiring as easy as 1, 2, 3. Post, screen, and interview all on Indeed. Get your quality shortlist of candidates whose resumes on Indeed match your job description faster. And you only pay for the candidates that meet must-have qualifications and schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. It makes connecting with and hiring the right talent fast and easy. With tools like Indeed Instant Match and Indeed Skills Test, you can choose from more than 130 skills tests, then add your must-have requirements so you only pay for the applications that meet them. If you're hiring, you need Indeed. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/locked. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/locked. Indeed.com/locked. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions do apply. And when you're done hiring the right person for your company, celebrate with a Built Bar, because it's the best tasting protein bar ever. I've told you about it before. If you're looking for a new nutrient bar, a protein bar that helps supplement your diet, and you're looking for a treat, something that doesn't taste like a protein bar, then you're looking for Built Bar, because there are 18 amazing flavors, all of which are covered in 100% chocolate. They're all soft and easy to chew. They're great for health conscious people. If you're looking to lose or maintain weight while indulging in that delicious treat, they're great for all sorts of diets. So right now, if you go to BuiltBar.com and use the promo code LOCKED15, you'll get 15% off your next order. So use the promo code LOCKED15 for 15% off BuiltBar.com. The Locked On Podcast Network is covering the NFL draft from all angles. Catch up on the Ultimate Mock Draft 2021 podcast presented by Odyssey. Follow Locked On NFL Draft and the Draft Dudes podcast for the latest draft news. And stay tuned for more info about our live NFL draft coverage. I'm here with Ben Golliver of the Washington Post and the author of Bubble Ball. It's such a fascinating, to me, the book, it seems like it's tailor-made for this kind of experience. Even as we're more and more, you know, less likely to read books in today's age, I feel like just the experience of the bubble and everything that it was, you did such a phenomenal job to me from, again, just the little bit that I was able to read of it over the last week. Just intertwining all the different aspects of what made the bubble so fascinating. Like, there was so much going on in the world around us, and then to be able to just get lost in the process of being in the bubble, but also having these outside reminders. Like, there was a really poignant part that you wrote there about a protest that took place in the Walt Disney World campus there, that they were interrupting your bus on the way back. I want to say it was from the Eastern Conference Finals. Am I mistaken there?
I think it was, it might have been game 6 of the Rockets Lakers. Okay. But that might have been the same time as game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Honestly, it might have been the same night.
Yeah, you're right.
I can't remember. Yeah.
You're right. But yeah, how like there were just little snippets of the outside world that still permeated into the bubble there. And you did such a great job of, again, mixing them together and showing like these kinds of nuances, these layers to not just the basketball being played there, but the human element and the worldly element, the politics of the movement and the world around us. So much went into the book itself. And you also imbued it with a level of just connectivity. Like you put yourself into the book a little bit. Like, you described moments where you were just going around walks, about, you know, missing your family, about, you know, following an egret that you named, was it Mikey?
Yeah.
Mikey.
Yeah.
That was amazing, man. Like, it was just so well done to see those kind of little snippets of your own life interwoven into a book like this. 'Cause that's rare. Like, you don't, you know, you read like classic books, like, you know, David Halberstam's The Breaks of the Game or something along those lines. And yes, there's a little bit of him in that, but mostly he's describing the Trailblazers and their season, right? This is a little different. Even as you're in the bubble, you have to know what that process was like for you, as well as a person covering this event, this once in a lifetime opportunity.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really appreciate everything you just said there, because, you know, that's exactly what I was going for. It's tricky to cover two different goals here. My first goal was to have a time capsule for this once in a generation, once in a lifetime wacky event where LeBron James and Jimmy Butler are fighting for the NBA Finals in Disney World, right? Like, if we had pitched that as something that was going to happen 3 years ago, we all would have said, like, what the heck are you talking about? That's crazy. And indeed, when they were first coming up with the idea of going to play at Disney World, a lot of people thought it was nuts and would never happen, right? Yep. So I really wanted to have a time capsule of just, you know, getting every single aspect and detail of that bubble experience just for history, so that basketball fans 20, 30 years from now could go back and read it and be like, well, what happened during the pandemic? How did they even handle it? And here would be sort of like historical record of it. At the same time, the pandemic has been really hard for all of us. Everyone has a story from the pandemic. And for me, when it first hit, I was just crestfallen of this idea that, you know, the NBA was going to be taken away from me. I had no idea what else I would even be able to do with my time. All I do is write and podcast about basketball. I mean, there was a real emptiness, a gigantic void, right? And so there was a real emotional journey there for me, coming from, like, you know, March, when there was no basketball, to the rising excitement and a little bit of fear from a health perspective when they were bringing it back. And then obviously it culminated in what I thought was a really entertaining and layered playoffs. And some, just some amazing, remarkable individual moments, the Bam block, the OG Anunoby three-pointer, you know, the Jamal Murray explosions, the Anthony Davis, you know, game winner. I mean, just go right down the list. Really memorable stuff happened. And, you know, for LeBron, you know, a pretty fascinating, like, you know, head-to-head duel against guys like Spoelstra and Riley, who really turned him into a champion, right? Helped elevate him into a champion. So just very, very rich narrative stuff. And so I just want the readers to kind of go along on the journey with me. I'm assuming most people who read this are going to love basketball, and that's who I wrote it for. You know, basketball fans, it's a basketball book with all sorts of other stuff in it. But it's this idea that, like, you know, I kind of got the golden ticket. I was really lucky to go down there and be there, and very grateful to have that opportunity. And so I just wanted to kind of, you know, let the, you know, let the readers feel those ups and downs, the challenging moments, you know, even that protest that you described. I mean, we're on the bus, and, you know, I haven't been able to see any protests in months because we're stuck there in Disney World. It was like a rare moment where the outside world actually kind of came into the bubble. And, you know, we're sitting there watching these people protest the police shooting of a Black man in Florida. And I'm realizing that it had happened, you know, 10 miles away. And I had not even heard about it, you know, because I'd been so engrossed with the basketball and the bubble. And that just kind of made me think, you know, back to the George Floyd situation where, you know, if there's not video, how many of those kinds of incidents are there that never make the news? And, you know, there was, you know, another moment kind of along those same lines where, you know, there's a hotel about 8 miles away from where they played the finals, and in Kissimmee, Florida. And there was a huge profile story written by a Washington Post writer detailing how there was no electricity, how the owner had abandoned it, how there was like a bunch of people squatting in these hotel rooms, how they, a lot of, there had been like COVID outbreaks, and basically how a lot of people who had been on the margins of society were pushed beyond the margins by the pandemic and had basically like living among, you know, gunshots at night and, you know, drug dealers and all this stuff at this hotel. And it's like, you know, literally a 5 minute drive from where I'm going to watch these games and chartered buses and, you know, empty stadiums and everything else. And so there were some real moments of just kind of privilege check. You know, it's like, well, when adversity hits, the companies and the entities that have a lot of money to kind of handle it and to kind of make a path forward for themselves are able to do it. And, you know, in spectacular fashion. I mean, nobody got sick in the bubble. Not one person tested positive in the bubble, right? They didn't have to cancel a single game or postpone a single game because of health and safety reasons. And yet not very far away, the kind of the story of the two Americas, you're having people, you know, dying. And so those kinds of moments to me, I really wanted, you know, I was just trying to process them in real time and having a hard time doing it. And I think a lot of people found themselves in that same spot in the bubble. And so hopefully I had enough reflection as I was writing it so that, you know, people will be able to see where I was going with it. But I do think we're all going to look back on this pandemic in 2020 as one of the key moments of our lives, right up there with 9/11 and some of these other turning point moments. I mean, previous generations talk about like the Berlin Wall coming down or, you know, you go right down the list, but I think that's how we're going to view it. And so I just wanted to have that record both for me personally, but also for the NBA at large.
Oh, no doubt. Your last line of the book, and I hate giving it away, but the bubble was for diehards, and the diehards should never forget it. I think that's so perfect, because to me, it was just such an incredible experience. Like, even just from covering it on the outside, obviously not as immersive as your own, but watching a 1 o'clock tip-off against the Toronto Raptors on a Tuesday. So it's so rare, you know, and watching, like, this was our first taste of basketball in months. Like, I was there in mid-March when we found out about Rudy Gobert and the NBA shutdown, and it was just so abrupt, right? I mean, we've talked about it before, but it was just so sudden. All of a sudden, you're watching a game, you're watching the Miami Heat lose a midseason game to the Charlotte Hornets at the American Airlines Arena. I remember talking to another reporter and saying, well, I guess I'll see you next season, because there was no chance that the season was going to restart anytime soon. We already had kind of seen the writing on the wall for a few days, few weeks, and it just built to this moment where it shuts down right there in the middle of this game being played out, a meaningless game, it turns out. And then, of course, months later, you start seeing, you know, news about the bubble being formed and everything that would entail. And of course, that just starts building slowly and slowly, and you're a part of it. And it was a fantastic experience. I'll never forget it. Like, and I think that Heat team was so perfectly built for it. I was kind of curious about your thoughts on the Heat and how they adjusted, because again, you and I had talked about Miami and their chances of advancing, but you were pretty honest about not necessarily giving them the best chances of being able to get past either the Bucks or the Celtics, or even certainly not the Lakers. What was it about that team that you think prepared them for the challenges of the bubble? Obviously, we can all oversimplify it as Heat culture, or that they were just built for this experience. I certainly heard that a lot from players themselves, but what was your take on why the Heat were able to thrive in the moment?
Well, one thing that always jumped out to me, when I did that profile about Jimmy Butler back in 2014, 2015, you know, he told me that he prepared for that season, which was his breakout year, right, by essentially canceling his cable, never going out, really diving into the early morning workout routines that he's kind of become famous for now. It's almost become, again, a self-parody of, you know, Jimmy's in the gym at 3:30 a.m. or whatever, right? But that was the year where he got absolutely crazy serious about working out, you know, three or four times a day workouts, and just no days off. I mean, that's really where it kind of like turned the corner for him. I think that in the previous years to that, he started to realize, like, look, I'm not just a role player, right? I'm not just the last pick in the first round of the draft. I have the potential to be a lot more. I could be a star. You know, I could potentially be the franchise player for this team with Derrick Rose, you know, starting to fade a little bit because of injuries. And so I think it was just the fact that they were an all basketball group. And you look at the major figures, they all had a lot to prove. Goran had a lot to prove after never really having a bunch of postseason success. Bam had a lot to prove, you know, solidifying himself as a first-time All-Star last year and getting himself, you know, thought of among the elite big men in the league, as opposed to a guy who was, you know, passed over by a bunch of teams in the draft and viewed maybe a little bit more as a project when he was first coming up, and right on down the list with a lot of their other players. So I think it was the mental toughness and focus and the ability to, you know, kind of put quote unquote real life to the side for a while. You know, I think that, you know, in that Milwaukee series, you know, Milwaukee had bad luck. I mean, first of all, Giannis getting injured for sure. The really careless foul by Giannis on Jimmy in the last second, you know, kind of tilting, you know, that series in Miami's favor for good. But I think also, you know, they never pulled their chemistry back together from the regular season. And I think that the emotional weight of the Jacob Blake situation as well for the Bucks was really on their minds in a different way than it was for other teams because of the geographical proximity between Kenosha and Milwaukee and because of Sterling Brown's, incident previously with police. And so, you know, juggling all these things was really difficult for all the teams. I mean, the margin of victory in, you know, that game where, you know, Jimmy Butler gets fouled by Giannis. I mean, that's a 2-inch difference in that game, right? No foul there. It goes to overtime. Who knows what happens, right? And so I think that for Milwaukee, their key personalities were just strictly business the whole way through. They weren't in a rush to get out of there. There was other teams like Houston and the Clippers, the Sixers, who you could tell were distracted, right? It was either, you know, the Lou Williams strip club incident. It was the Daniel House fiasco with the visitor in his hotel room. And so he gets booted out. Or it was the Sixers constantly saying, oh, wow, we wish we could go back and play in home court. They just never really adjusted to their environment down there. And for Miami, it was like, all right, we're playing an empty gym. Fine. You know, we're playing in a bubble. Fine. Who cares? Let's just go forward. And each team had to adapt to those circumstances differently. But I thought both Miami and Denver did a great job of just treating it like, look, you know, we can only control what we can. Let's go out there and do it. And I think that, you know, Spoelstra deserves a lot of credit for that too, because I think, you know, ultimately that is exactly who he is, right? I mean, he's coming up from University of Portland. You know, I've been to that gym there. It's not very big, right? You know, I think that, you know, sometimes the humble root stuff, and same thing for Jimmy going through the junior college experience, like, you know, what's really the difference between that and playing in the bubble? You know, it's a lot different than if you're somebody who went to Duke and you're used to the 20,000 fans every single night and all that other stuff as well. Right. So I do think that they were kind of tailor made for it. Sure. But I also think that, you know, until the finals, they also, you know, caught some breaks too, you know, in terms of like Hayward being out for part of the Eastern Conference, Giannis with the ankle injury, like I mentioned, Milwaukee just not being able to pull itself together. And then in the first round, they basically got a bye. You know what I mean? So there was some fortune that played a factor as well, but they made their own luck too. Let's not understate that.
I'll be finishing my conversation with Ben Golliver of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Locked On Heat. With an ever-increasing number of makes and models, it's impossible to stock all the parts you might need in a traditional chain storefront. Why endure pointless or intimidating questions while the person behind the counter orders the parts you're looking for on their computer? You've got access to computers in your pocket or at home, and you've got access to rockauto.com, a family-owned business that's been serving auto parts customers online for 20 years. You can choose from hundreds of manufacturers on their easy-to-use site. So great to navigate. You get everything you need with just a few easy clicks delivered directly and safely to your door. Why spend more for the exact same parts at a chain store? rockauto.com's low prices are the same for everybody. So if you go to rockauto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car or truck, then go to the section that says, "How did you hear about us?" and just write the phrase "Locked On" so they know we sent you. Amazing selection, reliably low prices, all the parts your car or truck will ever need. That's rockauto.com. Ultimate Mock Draft 2021 presented by Locked On and Odyssey is happening right now. Featuring analysis from NFL experts Michael Irvin, Jason LaCanfora, and Brian Baldinger, our local experts for every team are making trades, picking the next stars from their team. So search the Ultimate Mock Draft 2021 on the new Odyssey app or wherever you get podcasts. Odyssey is your audio home for all the sports, podcasts, music, and news that matter to you. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y, Odyssey. In your descriptions of Miami and their magical run, there were a lot of great snippets there. Of course, you spent a lot of time focusing on the Bucks and that matchup because I thought it was a really interesting one. And I think it was one that a lot of teams saw that there was going to be this natural, you know, crash course where they were going to necessarily bump into each other in the playoffs. And Miami, of course, I think made those moves for Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder last year, specifically so that they could build the defense with that wall to shut down Giannis, with the thought process that they were going to meet Milwaukee at some point in the playoffs. So it wound up working out exactly as everybody had predicted it would. But you also talk about Bam's block and seeing that live and seeing that on replay and just marveling at the sheer physics of it, something that I think a lot of us still do. Even recently, Bam Adebayo spoke on Duncan Robinson's podcast and talked about that block and his recovery, his realization that he needed to make a move there. And it was just a fascinating insight to what his thought process was during that and how he still just looks back because it was such an iconic moment. I think right up there alongside Ray Allen's game six shot as far as, you know, classic moments in Heat history. But Jimmy, I think, is the protagonist of the Heat. And certainly I think that comes across in your description of the team. One great story that you mentioned is when you were writing that first profile, how he called you up after at some point, I guess, because of the fact checking process being so arduous and not necessarily to his liking. And he was just ripping you a new one. And that the only way you could get to talk to him at all and to quiet him down was by matching his voice and yelling back at him and showing that you had that kind of grit and tenacity. That's such a perfect Jimmy story too. Like that you had to respond with the same kind of level of aggressions just so he could go, okay, let's talk about it. Now that I know you're up for the challenge of what I represent. What a great story that was.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make too much out of it, but like, you know, it's very common when you're doing these big features that there's going to be some follow-up questions from editors where they're like, hey, we need to pin this down or we need to get a quote from here. And, you know, it was just some sensitive material that I just don't think that he really wanted to talk about with his family. And so, you know, I had to make that just call of like, hey, man, I need to know X, Y, and Z. And it's like, you know, you just kind of have to keep pushing and pushing. And it's like, you know, I'm not really personally enjoying this experience either, but we're all kind of all in it together because this is how stories get written. And, you know, it was obviously, you know, making him just a little bit defensive. Like, why do we have to do this? Come on, you know, other stories I've done, we haven't had to do this. And so he was getting a little bit, you know, fed up. But, you know, as I was trying to let him know, it's like, you know, writers, the fact check part is tough for writers too. You know, it's a really a heavy lift. You've got editors going through every single thing you're doing word by word, making sure it's right. So yeah, there was a little bit of an exchange there, but I think that ultimately was like fairly good natured. And, you know, a couple of years later, another funny Jimmy story, I didn't get in the book, but a couple of years later, you know, this was a clear case of like, you know, once the phone call was over, he wasn't going to bear any ill will. It was just kind of, you know, done out of his mind. Sure. After that little, you know, profane exchange. But I had another story with him. And the previous week I had written about Blake Griffin. And the lead to my story was these two kids at a commercial shoot for Blake Griffin with his Jordan sneakers. And the kids were just marveling at the size of Blake Griffin's calves. Uh-huh. And it was such like, and I just felt like I couldn't not write it because these kids are just like, you know, their mouths are agape looking at Blake Griffin's calves. Obviously he's known for dunking at that stage of his career, you know, like slam dunk contest champion, all that. And so I opened with that as my story. And when I called Jimmy for our interview, the story had run about 3 days prior to my call with Jimmy. And he starts off the phone call. He's like, all right, are we going to talk basketball or do you want to talk about my calves? So he's just kind of roasting me a little bit. And, you know, it's not like we're like really close friends or anything like that. But someone had sent him that story, I think, or maybe he came across it, you know, in the prep before the call. And I think he was just trying to like, you know, lighten the mood, but also give me a hard time for, you know, writing about Blake Griffin's calves. So that one, you know, it's kind of the bookend where like we might have been a little angry on the first call, but I always remember that one liner from Jimmy so fondly because he is such a magnetic personality if you get him Absolutely. In the right situation. And he's such a good leader. I mean, the way he treated Tyler Hero, showing up to practice with the kid's high school jersey on, that was beautiful. I mean, I think for anyone, when you're talking about leadership, team dynamics, you know, how to make people better, to me, that really dropped my jaw. It's like, I love that moment for Tyler. He's never going to forget it. And I think, you know, for Jimmy, who's had kind of that prickly personality, you know, and not always gotten along with teammates, I love that moment for him too, because I think it showed some evolution and him understanding that, you know, how he has to conduct himself to help a team win at the very highest level.
Yeah, he did the same thing with Spoelstra too, didn't he? Wear like his University of Portland jersey at one point. Yeah,
for sure. No, the jersey thing is awesome because I love jerseys too. I actually have a jersey collection, so that one hit close to home. But you know, it's just this idea that like some superstars, when Tyler Hero goes off in the Eastern Conference Finals and gets all the attention, he's a rookie. Some superstars are going to try to turn that back on themselves and say, you know, like this is still my team. I gave him the opportunity. I want the attention.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And it was all about, hey, you know, and Jimmy even said that explicitly. And I quoted it in the book because I really admired him for saying this. He's like, you know, Spoelstra's not the one making those shots. I'm not the one making those shots. Pat Riley's not the one who's making those shots. Tyler's making those shots. He's the rookie. He's the one doing it. He's the person who's been in here working every single day, all his rookie season, to get himself ready for this moment. Give him the credit. And I love that because you don't always hear that from star level players in the NBA. Look, this is an ego league. This is a personality league. It's a brand league now, all of that. And for Jimmy to be so deferential in that moment, I loved it.
Yeah, I think Jimmy has done a fantastic job of that in his 1.5 years with Miami. Like even dating back to the start of last year, he talked about Bam Adebayo being the team's best player. And players that I've talked to and interviewed, they all mention how it almost seemed like he carried this team by sheer force of will, like just putting it out there, like speaking out into the universe that this team was going to go into the NBA finals and win a championship. Of course, it didn't quite work out that way, but Jimmy was just trying to change the mindset of that team and it worked. Everybody bought into it. Everybody followed his lead.
Yeah. And on that point, I mean, last detail from Jimmy with the book, but I mentioned this a couple of times during the finals, you know, I had booked my ticket home.
Yes.
After the first two games of the finals, because I was so convinced, look, you know, it's just too many injuries. The Lakers are going to sweep this thing. We're going home. And it was Jimmy who kept us all in the bubble, you know, for another week, basically, because he kept just not, you know, the 40-point triple-double, the amazing exhaustion performance, all of it. He kept extending that series. And I thought it was so perfect because so many of the other writers there were ready to go home. I had just a little bit of senioritis by the very end because it had been such a long journey. And you know, the days when we didn't have games during the finals were so empty. There was just nothing to do. And, you know, for him to still have that level of focus and desire to not roll over, to not fold like the Clippers did, to not fold like the Sixers did, to keep going and to be kind of a man of his word. Like you're saying, he wanted to speak it into existence. And they go down 2-0. He's like, I don't care what you guys say, you know, the media predictions. I know you're picking against us. Who cares? We're going to do this. He stuck to his script all the way to the very end. And I loved it. And, you know, I had to change my flight twice because, you know, he won, what was it, game five, when nobody thought they were going to win game five either. So we had to come back and play game six again. And I just remember the grumbling on the media shuttle bus when he did that, because people were ready to go home. People had black cars booked for that night of game five, you know, 2 hours after the game, you're going to be taken home and finally leave the bubble. And those had to be like, you know, canceled and rescheduled and pushed back a couple of days, all because of Jimmy Butler. It was amazing, man. I'm never going to forget his will and his competitive spirit.
Yeah, I don't know that we've ever seen anything like it. I mean, just the optics of the bubble, everything else that went into it, but his individual performance, maybe it was just the fact that we got a chance to see him longer than anybody else, or as long as anybody else, because he was there for all of it, that maybe we got to see a different version of him. But it seemed like he's such a great individual presence, even within the context of team play. So it was a phenomenal run for him. It was maybe not heroic, but it's certainly close to it. But I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about something LeBron said as well, that he found it to be the most challenging thing I've ever done regarding the whole bubble experience. And I think you can certainly appreciate that, considering you spent 93 days in the Orlando bubble. But one of the things that's always resonated with me after the championship there is that they try to dismiss LeBron's performance, calling him LeMickey and the LeBubble and all this crap. I mean, it's just so frustrating because you were there. And a point that I've made before is that if anything, there should be an asterisk next to last season because of how difficult it was, that it might have been possibly, like LeBron said, the most difficult NBA season in NBA history. I don't know how anybody could be so dismissive, but I'm curious what your take is on all that.
Well, first of all, they went 16-5 in the playoffs, right? So they won the title. This was not like they barely eked it out. I mean, they were the best team. They were the most deserving. There's kind of no way around that. So that would be number one for my counter on the asterisk talk. Number two is, and I was open to this idea of an asterisk before we got down there, because I wasn't sure would everybody be able to stay healthy. Yeah. Everybody stayed healthy, you know, at least from a coronavirus standpoint. Now injuries are going to happen. They always happen. So I don't think injuries should take away from a title. So, you know, if you're not going to give the Raptors an asterisk because Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson go down, then, you know, I don't think you can really give the Lakers an asterisk for that. The other point I would say is, look, if these games didn't quote unquote matter, if, you know, the league didn't view them as valid internally, we wouldn't have seen such widespread responses to the results. In other words, Milwaukee, they go and trade Bledsoe. And then they go and grab Holiday, right? Because they just realize we can't deal with this anymore. We've got to do something different. You look at the Houston Rockets, the whole thing blows up after the bubble. They treated that as a real postseason and decided, hey, we're not going to be able to get this done. The stars want out. Whole thing blows up. Philadelphia gets a new GM and a new coach and trades Horford, who clearly did not fit, as was exposed by both the regular season and the playoffs. You go right down the list of teams that were there who made pretty big moves in the upcoming offseason afterwards. And it's really hard to say whether it's coaching changes, whether it's trades, whether it's signings or whatever else. It's just really hard to make this argument that somehow this didn't matter, because otherwise everybody would say, just write it off. We'll just bring everybody back. We're fine. You know, I mean, Alvin Gentry, Brett Brown, these guys were fired days after the playoffs ended, right? When their teams get sent home. And in Gentry's case, actually before the playoffs, because they were knocked out in the regular season round, right?
Nate McMillan. So, right?
Nate McMillan as well, right? So you just add all those up. And I just think that, you know, ultimately, once the competition took place, the league treated it as real basketball and it was high level play as well. I mean, I think the lack of travel actually allowed players to get into great grooves, allowed teams to get into really good grooves, and it created high level basketball. I actually think the quality of play in the bubble exceeded so far what we've seen during this regular season, because of the protocol stuff, because of the delayed games, players in and out of the lineups. I think the post bubble hangover that struck a number of these teams, where they just haven't really been operating on the same level because they didn't get the full off seasons. To me, the bubble was a higher level, higher quality of play than this season. And so again, I would say it should be remembered as a real championship, and the LeMickey stuff and all that. I mean, look, I'm Michael Jordan's biggest stan. You know, I'm definitely always going to side with him in just about every GOAT conversation. But I don't think you know, putting an asterisk on LeBron's fourth or the Lakers title or whatever else is fair whatsoever.
Yeah, all good points, and I agree with almost all of them. I just think it's been a heck of a season this far, and just seeing it, just going over the memories of the bubble and everything else that it entailed, and just hearkening back to it, how good the games were. At least that was the feeling. Maybe it was just because we were all jonesing for basketball after that long stretch without it. But to me, I remember just thinking how good a lot of those games were. Even just the fact that the Phoenix Suns were able to win all eight games and just take their game to another level, and on there were so many great little stories here. And so it's such a fascinating book. Make sure everybody goes and buys it, please, because there are just details like that packed into almost every page. And just to relive a seminal, iconic moment in NBA history, I don't think anybody would be able to capture it as well as you did, Ben. But I did want to get some of your thoughts on this season, because Miami, not quite the same team as they were last year. You know, obviously they've gone through some roster changes. They've acquired Victor Oladipo. We have not had a chance to talk about that move yet. And of course, Oladipo currently out. I know you had mentioned recently that it was a pet peeve of yours regarding the lack of transparency regarding injuries this season. And certainly I think Heat fans are equally frustrated. What are your thoughts on Oladipo's fit and the fact that he may or may not even be available at any point soon, but nobody knows what's going on with the Oladipo's status.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, Miami, similar to the Lakers, similar to the Celtics, and similar to the Nuggets, you know, the four final teams left standing, to me, they've all been a little bit diminished versions of themselves this year. And I don't see that as a coincidence. You know, I mean, Jokic is the shining counterexample, because I think he's going to win MVP kind of going away. But right, when you're looking at like the Murray injury now and how slow Denver started this season, I think that it's a major competitive disadvantage to have to turn around as quickly as those four teams did. I mean, Anthony Davis just missed 68 days with a calf strain, right? Yep. And the Lakers offseason was 73 days. So he had a second offseason because he strained his calf. I mean, that sounds pretty weird and unusual, abnormal. And so when I'm looking at those four teams, I give them all a little bit of a pass in terms of, okay, like, you know, are we really expecting you to hit on all cylinders during the regular season? So for Miami, the big question is like, do they have enough to shift into gear once the playoffs hit? And to me, it's going to depend a lot on what their matchups are, you know, especially in the first round, where they land in the seeding battle, because their stars are still awesome and tough matchups, right? Like, you really don't want to have to draw Jimmy and Bam in the first round. Like, if you're the Brooklyn Nets, the difference between the one seed and the two seed in the East is huge, right? If you're right. If you're the Nets and you're going through the Heat, then the Bucks, then the Sixers versus, you know, whoever, the Charlotte Hornets and then the Celtics and then the Sixers, that's a much different path. And so I am hesitant to count Miami out by any stretch, but they haven't been able to sustain the same level of offensive efficiency and flow and just kind of togetherness and consistency that they were able to get to in the bubble. You know, you can count on their defense. It's going to be there, but are they going to have that other stuff that we just really haven't seen them string together a lot of wins, you know, so far this season? So I think that's the biggest question to me, but I'm not going to write them off because of those two star level players and how good they are, you know, matchup wise versus everybody. Of those three teams that they could face in the, you know, it's most likely they're going to probably, you know, get one of the three favorites in the East. Is there somebody you would like them to play more than the other two?
I my tendency is that maybe Milwaukee would be that team, just because they seem to have had their number in the past, but this is a different Bucks team that they faced last year or previously, so I don't think they match up as well. I think the Philadelphia series probably presents, I don't know if it's the easiest matchup, but it would probably be one of the more dramatic ones considering Jimmy's role with the Sixers and everything else. So especially if there's not going to be a bubble this year, I think it would be interesting to see Jimmy respond to Sixers fans booing him. I'm sure they would probably do so quite loudly. So that would be interesting. I all of them have little aspects to them that either would expose Miami or Miami might have a chance to dominate. And so I think it's, I don't favor any one of them, to be honest with you. I maybe Brooklyn, this depending on the health of their three stars and the fact that they have not played together for a long stretch of time. I mean, yes, they have the talent to trump what Miami can do, but there needs to be chemistry. And in a seven game series, you trust that a team like Miami, as well coached as they are and with the kind of players that they have, would be able to find some way of figuring out Durant and Harden on the floor and to be able to limit what Irving can do. Although, look, it's impossible to gauge what Miami can do in the playoffs because we're not sure what the version of the roster will be. Like, will it have Victor Oladipo? Will he be healthy? Will he be available at all? I mean, so much of it kind of hangs on Oladipo's health. And then you have other X factors that I've brought up a number of times, like Goran Dragic. We're not going to get the same kind of production from him that we got last year in the bubble. And so there's so many different X factors to Miami's postseason that I'm not sure you can predict how they'll match up against any one of those top three teams.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, if Harden's healthy, that's the team I would want to play the least if I was Miami. Sure. Because I do think that they've got so many all-around just polished, you know, offensive playmakers that, you know, doing some of the junk defense stuff or like, you know, like Miami was so great at just, you know, kind of forcing Giannis into his uncomfortable zones. Guys like KD and Harden don't have uncomfortable zones, you know, they're just awesome everywhere. And so I think I would worry about Miami's ability to generate scoring in that series to kind of keep up. I would love to see the Philly series, not only from the narrative standpoint that you're describing, you know, Jimmy versus the former team, but also like, here's a team that knows how to get it done in the playoffs versus a team that's like really been defined by its postseason shortcomings these last few years in the Philadelphia 76ers, and just an awesome positional matchup inside, you know, with Embiid, you know, kind of needing to prove it. And Bam, I think if you're drafting anybody in the Eastern Conference to want to have as part of your big man core to go against Embiid, I think Bam's your first pick, right? So I think I would circle that one and love to see it. You know, a Milwaukee-Miami rematch would be interesting as well. I do think Oladipo probably looms largest, though, in that Brooklyn series, wouldn't you say? I mean, you just have to have another scoring option in somebody else who can give you minutes defensively against both of Brooklyn's guards. I think that's the toughest part. I don't really trust Oladipo. I don't think he's been very good this year. I think it was a worthwhile gamble from Riley in terms of, you know, just see what you can get and, you know, trust that he's going to be more helpful in the matchups we're describing than a player like Olynyk, and pretty low price. But I mean, Oladipo hasn't been good in like 3 years. I think that's part of the problem, you know, and he also hasn't been healthy basically, you know, consistently here for the last couple of seasons either. So I would say that my personal expectations on him are pretty low. And the lack of clarity in terms of what exactly he's dealing with is always a red flag to me. And I do wish the NBA would clean that up. I think it's better for fans, opposing players, coaches, you know, television viewers, people who are betting on the games, just everybody should have a much clearer understanding of what players are dealing with from an injury perspective and how long they're going to miss. Because I think otherwise you're just kind of doing a disservice to everybody involved.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk again at some point as Miami does or does not make the postseason, because right now they're still challenging, even fighting for a play into spot. So it'll be interesting to see how they wrap up the last 12 games of the season. But I always ask this question of anybody who writes a fantastic piece, but was there anything that you left off from your bubble ball experience that did not make the final edition of the book that you want to share with my listeners?
No, I think the number one thing that I had to kind of cut really was Kobe Bryant and his role in the Lakers. And obviously his death overshadowing everything in Los Angeles here where I live for the last couple of years. And so I wanted to keep the book mostly, you know, centered around the actual bubble experience and sort of when it impacted the Lakers. You know, for example, Anthony Davis's shot where he yells out Kobe and, you know, Frank Vogel calls it the Mamba shot. Of course, I wanted to get that in there.
Sure.
But you know, it was just so hard. I mean, you could write an entire book about Kobe's, you know, final couple of years, you know, of his career and the impact on the local community. And so that was the toughest cut for me because I think the first draft had quite a bit more Kobe and it was about kind of streamlining it. But, you know, for the Lakers, I don't think people should overlook how quickly their turnaround happened. I mean, you know, basically a year and a couple months before the bubble, Magic Johnson abruptly resigns.
Right.
They part with Luke Walton. They trade for Anthony Davis. They get Fogle after potentially he's not even their first choice as a head coach. And they put it together instantly within a single season in which Kobe Bryant dies. And they have the China controversy where LeBron and Hong Kong and all that's, you know, kind of getting thrown in their face during the preseason. So telling the story of the Lakers turnaround and Kobe Bryant's role in it was probably the most tricky thing to do in like, you know, in a short period of time. And so I guess, you know, part of me wishes, hey, maybe there was another 15 extra pages about Kobe just so that people kind of understand his role within, you know, the NBA at large and what he meant to this city. But, you know, ultimately, it's a book about the bubble. It's not just about the Lakers. And so there was a balance there.
Yeah, and the reality is that if Bam and Goran had been healthy, they would have been crowned champions anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
So you could write the postscript for the next edition. When it goes to paperback, I'll let you do the alternate history version. How's that?
Yes, excellent. Thank you so much. You heard it here first. Make sure you go out and buy Bubble Ball Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season. You can get it from pre-order, but you can also get it available May 4th in hardcover. That's Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me, Ben.
Thanks for having me, man. All the best to you, and I look forward to chatting as we get closer to these playoffs.
Absolutely. Just a reminder that you can always reach me via email at lockedonheat@gmail.com or via Twitter using the hashtag AskYellowHeat. Be sure to please subscribe to the show and leave a review. Special thanks to all of our sponsors for supporting the show, and thanks to all of you. I'm David Ramil signing off for now.